our gypsy problem. By our count, there have been 333 gypsy incidents in the city of Blackhawk over the past century. There were the tomato wars during the ragman resistance, when vendors peddling goods from the backs of donkey carts went on strike. None of us who played in the Continental Little League will forget the day a pack of gypsy teenagers made good on a threat to steal every base from our diamond. The human chain of riffraff that shut down traffic on the Kimball Street Bridge to protest tolls on non-motorized vehicles was front-page news for the better part of a week. Most noteworthy of the gypsy incidents was the catastrophic burning of the city, the Gypsy King's Inferno. Officially an accident, the inferno ravaged Blackhawk for 7 days and nights while miraculously leaving the Monkey Wrench, the rumored meeting place of the Bimbe clan's Chris, without so much as a dusting of ash. These were strange times in Blackhawk, both frightening and fascinating for a young boy to come of age. The last of the Great Acorn Wars had finally come to an end with the blinding and expulsion of Gopa Little King Bimbe from our city. The memory of the Gypsy King's Inferno haunted our grandparents who survived that catastrophe in their youth. Living through those tragic times might have explained why grown-ups had little patience for our gypsy talk. They'd catch us plotting to track the gypsy twins or lay a track for Mike Dave, the fortune teller's grandson, and roll their eyes, tell us not to waste our time on such nonsense, just as they would if they caught us pretending to be El Gaucho or the Mongoose or any of the other luchadors we idolized. If only you spent as much time worrying about your English and math as you do those gypsies, our mothers would lament.
Thank you, Dan. And that's from All the Proud Fathers, a novel in stories. I'm finding that there's more of those out there, or maybe I didn't notice that before. Instead of a novel in stories. Did you go into writing this with that in mind, or did you go into this writing a novel?
With this project, I was thinking about a novel in stories. I had written an earlier manuscript, which has became a really short novella. Originally ended up, it was 500 pages long. And so that wasn't working.
That's not a novella.
No. And this is different from a traditional short story collection, I think, because there's the city of Blackhawk is sort of the through line that connects everything.
And it's a fictional city.
It is.
Blackhawk,
yes.
In Illinois.
Yes. Yeah, so I didn't really think of it as each story being separate. I saw each one informing another, or at least building the world, helping to build the world. So I always knew they were linked in some way. I wasn't sure where it was going. I would write things and kind of create certain mythologies in the stories and then sort of write other stories to answer those questions where, well, what happened then? Why did, you know, the Great Acorn Wars, what are those about? I was writing sort of to answer those questions for myself.
Is Blackhawk a conglomerate of the places you've lived, or it's, how did you create this place?
When I first started writing short stories, I was working really hard to keep them set in the real world. I grew up in Elgin, Illinois, which is about 35 miles northwest of Chicago. So I would try as hard as I could to make everything exactly as it was in the real world. Or stories that I had that were set in Chicago, where a lot of my family lived and I spent a lot of time as a kid. I became sort of a slave to verisimilitude in those stories. And I found myself spending too much energy trying to make things right and worrying about what was right instead of having fun and inventing characters and stories. So once I sort of came on this idea of this city called Blackhawk, things kind of just, the floodgates opened. Things really kind of started rolling for me. And in Blackhawk, it's part Elgin, but it's part Kalamazoo, Grand Rapids, any number of Rust Belt cities. That's, you know, Gary.
So you live now in Grand Rapids, but you have some roots in Kalamazoo. And in fact, I would say this story collection has roots in Kalamazoo.
Yes, I moved to Kalamazoo in 1999 for my MFA. And I was lucky enough to work with Stu Dybeck and Jamie Gordon.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't know I wanted to do anything beyond, you know, just finishing school with an English degree. Didn't know what I wanted to do. I liked writing. My creative writing professor at the time, as an undergraduate, suggested I consider an MFA program. And one of the writers I read in his workshop was was Dieback, and I read the story Hot Ice, and that was really important for me, that story. For the first time, I was seeing characters that I knew, people that I knew and heard, and neighborhoods I knew. They weren't exactly my neighborhood. They were very familiar to me. And so, you know, this was a long time ago before social media. And so I wrote Stu a letter and just asked him about the program. And I sent him a story, and he wrote me back and said, yeah, you know, he gave me some tips and said, if you're serious about it, think about applying here. And then back then, Western had a writer's conference. And so I attended for that, and I got to meet Stu and came here for my MFA, and then moved up to Grand Rapids and worked teaching a lot of different places. And then I came back for my PhD and finished my PhD in 2014.
And you taught at Kalamazoo College for a little bit.
Yes, I was filling in for someone one semester. In fact, I think Jamie Gordon got me that job. I was, kind of a struggling grad student in my PhD program. Just could, use some extra income. And that was fun. That was my first time, getting to teach at a smaller school.
And now you teach at Kendall Aquinas?
Yes. I'm primarily at Aquinas College right now, but I do teach creative writing at Kendall College. And that's fun seeing the difference with the students, my art students at Kendall, and then more of traditional liberal arts students at Aquinas.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I'm going to bug some of my Kendall students who are graphic design majors to help me update my website. So
there you go. Yeah. Take advantage.
Yeah.
So what are some of the most important lessons you've learned from Jamie Gordon, Adam Skytema, who's been on this show a couple of times and was also an advisor, I believe, on the manuscript, and Stu Dieback? What are the things you've learned over your journey as a writer? What are you passing along to your students?
I hadn't read any of Jamie's work before I came to Western. And then, I started reading her novels and just was really amazed with just the element of surrealism or fantasy in her writing. But what I learned a lot from her was paying attention to sentences at the line level. She used to take me to task for some of my sloppy and loose sentences. And I'm still, might be guilty of that. But I learned how to edit my work from her.
Yeah.
With Stu, I really learned to think about credibility, asking, what do my characters want in every scene? And are their actions supporting what they want?
Ah, okay.
As far as just writing in general, I think I learned patience more than anything. It just takes time. The oldest story in this collection, I want to say, is almost 20 years old, and I wrote it. It was a short flash piece that I wrote when I was an undergraduate.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was going to do with that, and it just, kept it in the drawer, and it fit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Adam Skytema was an advisor for my PhD. We were required to ask a faculty member from another institution to come in, and so he was reading my dissertation. But Adam's a really good friend. We knew each other from our MFA days.
Yeah.
Adam and I always joke around. We share work with each other and, pass work back and forth. And I always say one of these days I'm going to, write a grown-up story like the stories you write. And, he'll, say, someday I'll write, a more of a magical story like you write. So, but no, he's a fantastic writer. And
there was a commonality, in fact. Skytema has Freshwater Boys, Haymaker, just had a new book come out, too. He talked about, in his interview, about fantastic events in regular, everyday life. And you do something of the same there.
Yeah, and that's important to me. And I don't necessarily think about that if I'm writing a chapter or writing a scene, that something strange has to happen now. My writing process is that if I don't know exactly what I need to work on for the day or the morning, I'll just start writing and keep writing until something surprises me. More times than not, that's something unusual. But I do like the interplay between the real and the fantastic, especially in the backdrop of the city of Blackhawk that I write about, this blighted area. And I like to superimpose, these fantastic elements to that. I think when people think of magic realism, Macondo, Marquez comes to mind, and was one of my favorite writers. But I want to see that magic realism in a city that's fallen on hard times.
Somewhere I read that you referred to your style as magic naturalism. Does that still work for you?
Oh, I guess. And maybe I was thinking writer like Richard Wright or any number of, you know, the Chicago writers, Algren, Studs Terkel even. So, yeah, I don't know if it's still appropriate to call it magic naturalism. I think that was just something I came up with when an editor was asking me to define what I was doing. So,
yeah. Talk about the title. That actually comes from a poem.
Yes.
Not yours.
No. The title is a line from James Wright's poem, Autumn Begins in Martins Ferry, Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, that poem, you know, while not about you know, necessarily the Rust Belt, it's all the imagery in that poem is, you know, could be in the Rust Belt. It could be, you know, Muskegon, or you know, it could be Racine. It doesn't really matter. And I like that poem as well in relationship to my stories, because a lot of these pieces feature relationships between fathers and sons or fathers and daughters. You know, the last story in the collection is about a priest, so there's another father in that way. And so, yeah, I always liked that poem. I always had it in the back of my mind as, if not to use as a title, to use in a story somehow.
And you've got all these rich characters in these stories. And I understand one of your personal interests is professional wrestling, and that kind of makes its way into this book, too.
Yes, that's a not-so-guilty pleasure. I'm, in fact, we mentioned Adam Skydema. He's coming over this weekend to watch WrestleMania with me. So there's something about the characters in professional wrestling that immediately draws me in. And when I first started writing fiction or thinking about writing fiction seriously, I was drawn to writing stories about wrestlers. For one thing, you have these made-up, kind of already established character traits, you know, good guy, bad guy,
and larger than life.
Larger than life.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that idea of identity and realism. What are these people doing? Are they projecting something that they are, or they're, you know, they want to be? And then sort of the sleight of hand that they're making something look real that's not in some way.
Kind of what you do.
Yes. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of my recurring characters is this masked wrestler named El Gaucho, and I originally wrote a novel about him. It's, you know, opus, a 500-page mess of a book.
Your 500-page novella.
Yeah, and so, but I got a few good stories out of it, and I was preoccupied with this idea of what happens when this character takes a mask off and things don't go the way he likes. So, yeah, and there's something about that, I guess, the ritual of, you know, violence or performance in wrestling that is interesting to me. So they make appearances in some of these stories as well.
Would it be fair to ask you about a favorite character? Or is that like asking a parent to pick a favorite child?
I would say my favorite character is probably Uncle Angelo.
Okay.
He's sort of this down on his luck, former boxer who spends most of his time teaching life lessons to his nephew, who he calls Maestro. We never really learned the nephew's name. He's just, you know, one time someone was talking about this story with me when I was working in an early draft, and he called him, this is, you know, a great prototypical American loser. And I wasn't really fond of that, but he's certainly more of like a dreamer. And if a close second, I guess, for a character that I would like would be Flaco Rivera. Similar with his Uncle Angelo, just not really able to get what he wants, trying to find his place in the world, kind of a little bit of a dreamer. And with both of those characters, I think their voices are the most distinct of any of the characters in the book. And the voices just sort of came to me when I was writing them. My Uncle Angelo is probably, you know, a group of voices from, my, you know, people I knew, older guys in the neighborhood or uncles.
And the whole collection won an award. Congratulations, the Sou'wester Award.
Yes.
Talk about that, the meaning of something like that. It seems to me that a lot of publication these days is associated with an award.
I think that speaks to how difficult it is to be published through the traditional route going through New York. Before this manuscript was completed in 2014, and at the time I had published or had placed every story in the collection in a literary magazine. So I knew at some level this is a good piece of writing and people like to read it, but I was just not getting anywhere, sending my work to agents. I had probably 200 submissions to publishing houses and agents.
Which is more typical than not.
Yeah. So I know that, and I didn't realize that at first, like 10 years ago when I started sending things out, but you learn that. That's part of the process. And I think with, as far as the prizes go too, that sort of, it's a way for publishers to develop new writers or to introduce new writers to the community, and it's a way to give them a few bucks too. It's not like we're doing this to make a lot of money anyway, but
yeah, unfortunately not. There's truth in that stereotype of starving artists.
Yeah.
And at some point, back to your days at Western, you were also an editor, fiction, nonfiction with Third Coast, a much-loved literary magazine. I'm wondering what perspective you gained from sitting on the other side of the desk. Did that help you become more patient with those 200 submissions?
Oh, absolutely. And I tell my students all the time, my creative writers, if you have the opportunity, work for a magazine, work for a literary magazine. You'll appreciate how much, a polished manuscript, how important a polished manuscript is. The editing is so important. Being patient, for sure.
With yourself or?
With myself as a writer, but, this will take a while to be published.
Okay.
And not rushing the work to send it out.
Yeah.
Definitely, though, being patient with just responses from magazines. These are offices that are staffed by people who, aren't really paid very well, if at all. Overworked graduate students. And there's a stack of manuscripts that they have to get through. So I always tell my students, make sure you have just, a simple cover letter. And the cover letter is really the first sign of, do I want to read anything else?
It is. It's important. I've worked on that side of the desk, too. And for one thing, following guidelines. It's amazing to me how many writers will not take the time to look at the guidelines.
Yeah. Now, there's really not much of an excuse for that, just because it's online all the time and on mastheads in magazines. But yeah, I know I've fallen, I've mistakenly sent longer pieces out to magazines too, so I'm guilty of that as well. But
if it's good writing, I'm sure you did that too as an editor. If it's good, you're going to find a way to fit it in.
Yes.
So what are you working on now, Dan?
I'm writing a novel that's set in Black Hawk in 1932.
You like Black Hawk?
I do. It's a place that I can keep writing about and finding new characters. And
yeah.
I originally had the project in mind to answer one of those questions, these events or these histories that I reference in All the Proud Fathers. I wanted to backtrack and find out, what was this Gypsy King's Inferno? And it morphed into something else. So the novel's about this orphan who comes to the town and grows up in the city. And he starts working for this captain of industry, this man who just is building this railroad from Buenos Aires to Black Hawk. He wants this trans-hemispheric railway because he's fallen in love with a tango dancer.
Yeah.
And the orphan grows up to fall in love with the tango dancer as well. So there's a little bit of a love triangle there. But it's this exploration of the city of Black Hawk again.
And again, these rich, unusual characters. So I think that's becoming your trademark.
I just wanted to thank the English department at Western for giving me this opportunity. The early draft of this was my dissertation, and I had the time to write while I was here, and that was really wonderful. And Western is such a great community of writers. I think of someone like Bonnie Jo Campbell or Adam Skydema.
Kalamazoo in general. Like Kay has a lot of great writers in there too. So I think there really is something in the water.
Yes. Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo. And it's just a wonderful community. And I'm always happy to come back here and